Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Three guests today. Bruce Bartlett will talk about the exotic dance performed by Republicans as they embrace the Confederacy while trying not to look racist. Alex Gurevich will explore the hidden dangers in cracking down on gun possession. And Saki Bhatti will analyze the fiscal crises of Detroit and Chicago. First, Bruce Bartlett. Bartlett, no stranger to these airways, is a former conservative Republican who worked on Capitol Hill and in the think tank world before having a change of heart. The sight of South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley and some of her Republican colleagues endorsing the removal of the Confederate flag from the state Capitol building was slightly surreal, so I asked Bruce Bartlett to explain it for us. Welcome, Bruce. Were you surprised to see Nikki Haley joining the coalition to take down the Confederate flag from the South Carolina Capitol?
Well, I would have been surprised a month ago, but, you know, at the time it actually happened, I thought it was pretty much inevitable. And the reason, I think, is because the Republican establishment, the Republicans running for president, desperately want to kick this can down the road, and they desperately don't want the issue of the Confederate flag and all that it represents to become a national issue, so that they want to maintain that it is a purely local issue in order to keep Congress out of it, to keep Washington out of it. And for that to be a viable strategy politically to neutralize this issue, those at the local level, Republicans, have to step up to the plate and actually deal with it. Because if they don't, then it's inevitably going to become a national issue and the party will be in a very weak position.
This is really going to alienate a number of the Republican base. What does it mean to them? You hear it's just states' rights and heritage and history. What does it really mean to them?
Well, basically, the flag is a symbol of racism. And the Republican Party has inherited the racist culture of the South that, to be honest, was part of the Democratic Party for 150 years until the mid-1960s. And when the South turned Republican, the Republican Party inherited all of that ugly racist history. And they've winked and nodded, you know, for years and years, since at least the Nixon administration, trying to use symbolic terms to avoid making it appear too obvious that they are pandering to racists. And one of the most obvious is one that we've heard a lot since January 20, 2009, which is take our country back. But nobody ever explains back from whom. Well, obviously from the blacks, who now control the White House and are imposing some sort of dogma, or I don't know, even know what the right term is, onto white citizens, forcing them to integrate and be subservient to blacks and suffer from black racism and other utterly nonsensical ideas that nevertheless circulate within the right-wing community.
How much of a class divide is there within the Republican Party? It seems that the CEO class was pressuring Haley to join the Take It Down party. But does it appeal to working class, poorer whites? Is that what it's all about, is to gin up support from people whose material interests are really not served by the Republican agenda?
Of course. It's been a subject of political science discussion for some years as to why poor and working-class whites so often vote against their own best interests, or their own best economic interests anyway, by supporting the party of the ultra-wealthy rather than supporting the Democratic Party, which is more represents their economic interests. And one popular theory is that Republicans and conservatives have used social issues such as religion and abortion and things like that. But race is also a big part of this. And keep in mind that again, how the Republicans have inherited a certain strategy for dealing with these issues that came out of the South, where the Democratic Party's elites, which were often called bourbons, would always use racism to divide the poor black white farmers from the blacks, so that they could not unite together and overthrow them. Now, every once in a while, a populist movement would come along that would unite the poor whites and the blacks together, and the Bourbons were desperately afraid of this. But the point is that the strategy still works, that somehow or other, and I don't even understand this, I just know that it works, some poor white fellow who's you know, just barely getting by somehow or other feels better if he knows that there are blacks out there who are even worse off than him. He's got some modicum of status that he will fight to the death to maintain, and fundamentally it's all about racism.
It was really quite amusing to watch the Republican candidates squirm in the last few days over this issue. Are they going to be able to swallow it and come around, or how are they going to deal with it?
Well, I think they're doing a pretty good job of cauterizing this issue. One problem you have is that the Democrats have historically done an extremely poor job of maintaining momentum on these issues when they get a break in their direction. And I'm glad to see the president has finally, after all these years, finally started to engage the race issue in a way that I thought he would back in 2009, but has steadfastly been reluctant to do so. Because one thing the president can do more than anything else is set an agenda and get people talking about particular issues, especially if he talks about it in a sustained way. So I think that this issue is also giving some, what shall I say, improving the morale of the Democratic Party because they now feel like they have an issue in which they can really go on the offense against Republicans in a way that the Republicans simply cannot deal with other than by trying to sweep it under the rug.
Well, I think Obama's calculation has been that drawing attention to his race would hurt more than it would help. Do you think he's wrong in that calculation?
I can't really say, but it's certainly consistent with his nature. It seems to me that Obama grew up, you know, obviously largely in a white world, and I think he learned from an early age how to succeed in that world. And he's obviously succeeded beyond his wildest dreams. But I think one price you pay for that is subordinating your racial and ethnic identity. And I think he's been very reluctant to call attention to the black side of his life, his existence, except very indirectly in his memoirs, but certainly not at all as president. My file of times that he has brought up the race issue explicitly is pretty thin. But maybe now he feels that he needs to leave some kind of legacy, and clearly his overwhelming legacy, the what will go on his tombstone, is first black president. And I think he wants that to mean something more than just breaking the ceiling, the black ceiling, or whatever you want to call it.
As Wayne LaPierre said recently, right, the demographically significant president, one is enough.
Well, he is that, no question about that.
People are saying that this taking the Confederate flag down would just be a purely symbolic gesture with no real material or political effects. Do you think that's true or not?
Maybe, but symbols are important. You know, there is actually some evidence in the political science literature that the Confederate flag has helped Republicans in electoral races. It, you know, I mean, like any other symbol, it galvanizes those who, I don't know the right terms, but I mean, it's a device that helps rally people for whom it appeals.
And do you think it's going to damage the Republican electoral base, or is it going to damage their appeal with the electoral base by surrendering on this crucial issue?
It's too soon to say. A lot will depend on how the racist right-wing Tea Party wing of the party responds to this. If they view the Republicans as having betrayed them, which many conservatives are in fact saying, it could be very negative. I think it also, like I said, empowers Democrats, stiffens their spine, emboldens them to be a little bit more aggressive than they have been over the last few years, where they seem to just cower in fear of an attack on Fox News or something like that. And it may have some beneficial spillover effects.
How central is the racist appeal, the coded or not so coded, to Republican electoral prospects? Do they have something beyond that, or is it really, really central?
Well, where I think it is most central is in the primary process. As you know, in the South, during the solid South era, when the Democrats controlled that region, the only election that mattered was the election of the nominating elections, the primaries, because blacks were not allowed to vote in those elections, and getting the Democratic nomination was tantamount to being elected. Hardly any Republicans got elected in the South during that era. So, and the same thing has now happened in the Republican Party, where the primaries are the be-all and end-all, at least for congressional candidates. And so they must pander to not just the specific group within their party who only vote in primary elections, which, I don't know, is maybe 10 or 15% of the Republican electorate. And those people are overwhelmingly the activists, the dogmatists, the ideologues, the single-issue voters. And so they can't walk away from those people too quickly, lest their chances of winning the nomination simply evaporate, which I think explains why guys like Mike Huckabee are being very, very careful about denouncing the flag. And some of the others figure they weren't going to get that vote anyway. They have nothing to lose.
That was the economist, writer, and former Republican Bruce Bartlett. While some people are dismissing the dethronement of the Confederate flag as merely symbolic, I'd like to point out that race is something like gender that has to be constantly produced and reproduced, and anything that interrupts that process can be politically fruitful. We'll talk guns after a musical break. That was the beginning of the first movement of Haydn's Piano Sonata No. 40, performed by Alfred Brendel. Next, Alex Gurevich. Gurevich is an assistant professor of political science at Brown and author of the recently published Slavery and the Cooperative Commonwealth from Cambridge University Press. After the Charleston massacre, there were the usual calls for stricter gun laws. Alex Gurevich had a piece on Salon the other day urging a rethink of that reflex. I'm not sure I'm convinced, but his perspective is worth listening to. Welcome, Alex. We're hearing calls from liberals and Democrats, starting with the guy in the Oval Office, in the wake of Charleston, we need gun control. Not really, I was going to say more gun control, but some gun control. You don't agree. What's your problem with this standard response?
My problem with the standard response is that it's going to make racial injustice worse rather than better, at least any of the standard forms of gun control we usually get, by which I mean gun control that involves in some way criminalizing gun possession or gun-related crimes. And that's by far the most politically popular form of gun control in America. It's by far the most likely form of gun control to get passed, whatever else is part of gun control legislation. And I think the effects of that, we already know the effects of that, is actually to make the over-policing and mass incarceration of poor urban blacks and Latinos much worse. And so the kind of bitter irony is this racial crime committed by Dylann Roof could end up getting used to pass legislation that will make things worse for poor blacks and Latinos.
Yeah, I was surprised when I read a comment on Facebook response to your piece that the incarceration numbers on gun offenses are pretty stark. Something like half of the people incarcerated on gun offenses are black, and then only about a quarter white, a quarter Latino. So that is not what one might expect.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a gun control regime is inevitably going to disarm, further disarm blacks, make them, especially blacks, but also Latinos. It's going to disarm blacks because of things like background checks and things like that, because blacks are much more likely to have a criminal record for very unjust reasons. And it will lead them to serving longer in jail, more likely to end up in jail. It'll lead them to having to plea bargain out. I mean, basically, the current regime for controlling guns and dealing with gun possession and gun-related crime already functions as a dragnet. And a lot of the things that we actually think are features of the drug war are actually features of gun control laws. So, for instance, the notorious stop-and-frisk regime by the New York Police Department, which year on year was, yeah, I mean, that was effectively a racial dragnet. I think they stopped upwards of 500,000 pedestrians a year, and it allowed them to stop them for no reasonable suspicion whatsoever. They could stop them, then they would search them and try and find either drugs or guns. And the justification for that policy was gun control. It wasn't the drug war. And that's just one example. And that's a necessary feature of criminalizing drug possession, because when you have a gun, the only way to find out is either you try and x-ray the person or you have to invade their civil liberties. Because if they're not in the practice, you know, if it's just possession, just as with drugs, you have to find some pretext of stopping them. And that's going to mean by necessity, it's going to, you're going to have a very invasive forms of policing. And that form of policing always disproportionately affects poor blacks and Latinos. In part because of the racist prejudices of cops, in part because if it were applied to any other group of people, it wouldn't be politically tolerated. So, and that's just the policing. And then once you get arrested, we know that the highly discretionary system of charging that prosecutors use ends up with a lot of racial bias. And so they'll load up, they're much more likely to load up extra gun charges on black and Latinos as opposed to whites. I have an unbelievable quotation actually from Michelle Alexander's book, which I didn't memorize, but it's basically a former U.S. prosecutor talking to his assistant DA who said, let's drop the gun charge against this guy. And the DA says, why? He says, he's a good old boy. He's a white guy from the country. He's not some gun-toting drug dealer, when in fact it was actually a white guy who was dealing drugs who happened to have a rifle. So once you get charged, you're going to get disproportionately charged with gun crimes, and then you end up in the criminal system.
What about restrictions on sale? I tried to adopt a cat through normal channels in New York City a few years ago, and it was actually more difficult, and I'm not exaggerating. I had to fill up more forms and jump through more hoops to try to do that than I would have had to go buy a gun in Virginia. What about restrictions on easy sale?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of things to say about that. I mean, one is part of the reason I wrote this piece was just to get people who I don't think consider the actual effects of gun control and of the using the criminal law to solve social problems on different populations. We've been having this big conversation about racial injustice and over-policing, and it applies to the gun control debate. And if we're worried about racial injustice, I sort of want to say, look, you know, we should try and not reach for the criminal law as our first response. What about other ways of thinking about how we'd want to build a better society rather than come up with yet another way of creating a crime out of a moral evil? So that was sort of a background response or reason for writing the piece, because there are some things that you could do around gun control, like regulations around point of sale and point of production, that would not entirely have the same effects that I worry about when it comes to things like gun possession and gun-related crimes. However, first of all, you're very unlikely to get any legislation that creates restrictions around point of sale without also more laws or more creating more crimes around gun possession and gun-related crimes. So it's very unlikely you're going to get what some kind of more progressive form of gun control without also this kind of criminalization aspect. But secondly, I mean, it's not likely to do very much. There's 300 million guns already in circulation in the United States that are already in circulation. So even if you make it harder to buy a gun from a gun seller, there's already 300 million out there. And if your plan is to try and reduce gun-related crime, you've got to find some way of getting those off the streets. And that's going to be – I don't see any non-invasive way of doing that. And finally, I mean, the thing about point-of-sale restrictions like background checks is who's that going to affect the most? It's going to be poor black and Latino men who already have criminal records. And it's going to just reinforce the already existing – you're going to disarm young black men unjustifiably because they have criminal records for bad reasons, for unjust reasons. But also it's just going to be another way of reinforcing this extreme second-class status of felons. I mean, the problem with mass incarceration isn't just Michelle Alexander talks about this quite well in her recent book. I mean, there's a lot of people who've talked about this, but the problem isn't just that you end up in jail. It's that once out of jail, you can't get housing, you can't get a job, you can't get anything. I'm not saying, well, isn't it great for you to have a gun? But the point is we've created this extraordinary stigma around being a felon or having criminal conviction, and I think people don't think about how laws like point-of-sale restrictions and background checks would actually reinforce those public and social attitudes.
You used the word disarm a couple of times, and it sounds a little like the NRA arguing that freedom of gun possession is the cornerstone of liberty. Are you making that argument?
I'm not making an argument, sort of a central argument. I think the NRA is a bunch of crass racists and it's horrible. This is part of, you know, I want there to be a good left-wing argument against gun control that is of the version I'm giving that really stands freely and independently of the ridiculous crap that Wayne LaPierre and all of those racists say. But it's not unreasonable if you're a very poor black or Latino man living in certain areas of the United States to want a gun. I don't live there. I've been to some of these cities, and I know a little bit what life's like. It's not an unreasonable thing to want a gun. I think it's unreasonable for white racists to think that possession of a gun is the cornerstone of their liberty. But the cornerstone of their liberty is a little bit different from the cornerstone of liberty of a poor urban black or Latino man. For the minimal reason, it's just like more – the reasons I say it. More gun laws means you're even more likely to get harassed and have your civil liberties violated by the police. But also they have legitimate self-defense concerns, I think.
Well, you bring up the fact that Ronald Reagan signed a very strict gun control law in California intended to disarm the Black Panthers. So that's a strange history for people now to be invoking.
That's right. Well, even better is the father of broken windows policing, James Q. Wilson, also was an extraordinary advocate of gun control. And he has this really remarkable article from 1994 in the New York Times called Just Take Away Their Guns. And it ends with him essentially describing gun control as something that would be unequally enforced against blacks and Latinos, but it's a price we should be willing to pay for the sake of gun control. Because he basically saw guns as like broken windows. It's sort of gun violence plus all these sort of small quality of life crimes adds up to destroying the fabric of the inner city. And so he says, I happen to have it up on my computer, so I'll just read you the ending because it describes in great detail what things ended up being like, which is, even if we do all these things, there will still be complaints. Innocent people will be stopped. Young black and Hispanic men will probably be stopped more often than older white Anglo males or women of any race. But if we are serious about reducing drive-by shootings, fatal gang wars, and lethal quarrels in public places, we must get illegal guns off the street. We cannot do this by multiplying the forms one fills out at gun shops or by pretending that guns are not a problem until a criminal uses one. In other words, criminalize gun possession, and let's accept that it will be amplifying racial injustice. Then this is 1994. It's not just Reagan disarming Black Panthers. This is sort of, you know, the 90s. And that's a clear-eyed description of what this is going to look like. And look, if you're the kind of person who thinks that failed gang wars and lethal quarrels in public places are worth the extraordinary price in the loss of liberty for poor blacks and Latinos, then you should come out and say it. But what bothered me is people don't even acknowledge that this is the, you know, the most likely and real cost of most of the most likely forms of gun control. And that needs to be at the very least explicit and public as the real effects of this kind of thing.
That was Alex Gurevich, who teaches political science at Brown. You'll listen to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some more of Haydn's Piano Sonata No. 40, performed by Alfred Brendel. Our next guest is Saki Bhatti. He's a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and author of several papers on what are essentially the planned fiscal crises of major American cities like Detroit and Chicago. Saki Bhatti. As you point out, you can Google the term the next Detroit and find any number of American cities nominated as being the next municipality to go into bankruptcy. You have been looking at Chicago. Why is Chicago not the next Detroit?
I mean, for a number of reasons. I mean, first and foremost, the fact that Chicago can't file bankruptcy. Literally, Illinois does not allow cities to file bankruptcy, so it's not even an option. But more than that, I mean, there's some key distinctions between Chicago and Detroit, namely that, you know, Detroit had lost 60% of its population from its peak, and Chicago, and, you know, there's huge swaths of the city that are sit completely empty. The tax base has been completely devastated, and Chicago is actually, by all accounts, still quite a vibrant city. There's a lot of wealth here. I mean, there's huge parts of Chicago, namely the, you know, south and west sides, which have been completely neglected by the city, that do in fact resemble Detroit. But there's actually also a lot of neighborhoods and the downtown which actually have a very healthy tax base, and there's a lot of untaxed wealth there. So, I mean, unlike Detroit, where there really was sort of a devoid of wealth, Chicago has a lot of wealth. It's just very unequally distributed. And so it's a matter of figuring out how we can actually, you know, replenish the city's coffers by actually properly taxing the wealth that does exist here.
And before we move back to Chicago, there were a lot of unfair and misleading things that were said about Detroit, right, about the water district, the debt levels, and then some nasty business with state assistance.
Absolutely. I mean, there is this narrative out there that the Detroit bankruptcy was inevitable, that there was no choice but to do that, and that's just not the case. The fact is that there are a number of things that sort of have come to be seen as conventional wisdom around Detroit that were false. One was the fact that that Detroit somehow had to figure out how to deal with $18 billion in debt to get out of bankruptcy. That's just not how municipal bankruptcy works. I mean, just because you had $18 billion in debt does not mean you have to be able to pay that off right away. For instance, if someone has a mortgage and they have $300,000 in debt, it doesn't mean they have to be able to pay that off right now. They just need to be able to make their monthly mortgage payment. Similarly, with cities, in order for cities to stay solvent, they have to be able to pay their bills as they come due. And in fact, the actual shortfall in Detroit was just $198 million, not $18 billion, which was sort of a hundredth of what it was made out to be. And, yeah, as you sort of alluded to, there are a number of ways that you could have actually met that shortfall. For instance, the state had slashed revenue sharing with the city by $67 million. If they had actually reversed that, they could have made up a substantial portion of that amount. There's other key issue that exists in Detroit, which is that the city is unable to collect income taxes on people who commute to the suburbs. they're legally required to pay them, but the state does not allow the city to deduct them from the payroll. And that costs the city $142 million. And so if the state just created a vehicle for the city to collect the tax that was already due, that could have helped fill that hole. I mean, and I want to just be clear, like, there definitely were structural issues that need to be addressed in Detroit. I mean, the huge population decline really did have an impact. It's not like if they'd come up with $198 million, the city would have been great and everything would have been rosy. There are lots of issues that need to be addressed there, but the city did not need to resort to bankruptcy to address them. It did so primarily because there was a political agenda to try to slash the city's pension obligations.
Yeah, what was that political agenda? The governor, Rick Snyder, this is longstanding desires of part of the Michigan establishment, right?
Absolutely. So, I mean, one of the things that happened after redistricting in 2010 is that the legislature went heavily Republican, and you also had in the 2010 Tea Party wave, Rick Snyder elected governor. And so upon coming in, one of the first things he started doing is building the drumbeat around the Detroit pensions, and Detroit pensions as being one of the key issues why the city was struggling. There was more than a slight racial lens to that, because Detroit is a predominantly African-American city. About 90% of the population is African-American, and they very much try to play to this notion that what you have is this African-American city that's sort of mooching off the rest of the state. And it has unsustainable pensions that's going to drag down the rest of the state, and, you know, we're not going to bail Detroit out. And the issue was that it really was an explicit agenda that was meant to – or, sorry, this was an agenda that was really meant to play off the tensions that existed between the city and the suburbs and the rest of the state, which really do fall along racial lines. The other sort of key part of this had to do with the water department, which the Detroit Water Authority, it's actually administered by the city of Detroit, but it serves 40% of the population of the entire state. All of southeastern Michigan is actually serviced by the Detroit Water and Sewer Department. And so that had been one of the other key issues that had existed, that people who had fled the city to the suburbs, who were overwhelmingly white, sort of wanted the water department to be in the control, or to not be in the control of the city anymore. It was the one sort of piece of political economic power that the city still played in the lives of the suburban residents, the fact that their water rates and that the way the water was structured was still sort of run by the city. And so that had been another longstanding goal. There had long been calls for regionalizing or privatizing the water to take it out of the hands of the city. And so basically the governor was able to use the bankruptcy to do both of those things. Both he was able to use it to slash the pensions and also to regionalize the water system, as well as a couple of other things like the Belle Isle, which is sort of this beautiful island in the Detroit River, that sort of sits between the city and the and Windsor, Canada, this great park. There had been this long sort of desire to also take that out of the control of the city, and that was also done through the bankruptcy. The state took over Belle Isle. Right? So there are a number of different goals that had long been desired by folks who live in the suburbs that were accomplished through the bankruptcy.
Now, of course, we're hearing similar rhetoric around Chicago, but Chicago's a very different beast. First of all, its mayor is not a minor figure in American politics, Rahm Emanuel, a major macher in American politics. And it also has a fairly healthy economy, even if maldistributed. Who's trying to accomplish what? And the governor, Rauner, has an agenda not unlike Snyder's?
Right. I mean, I think Chicago's sort of an interesting case because you have competing agendas. On the one hand, you have Governor Rauner, who was just elected, former private equity firm manager, who's really trying to run the state the way that private equity firm managers run their companies, which really is sort of slash and burn everything, to try to extract as much value as you possibly can and sort of, you know, lead the pieces. And so the governor is sort of pushing what he calls his turnaround agenda, which includes drastic anti-union measures. It includes trying to slash pensions and various other things that he's sort of trying to call reforms, which have been sort of soundly rejected by the legislature and even by a lot of the Republican local officials. He's also proposing deep draconian cuts his proposed budget will reduce state aid to municipalities by 50%. He's trying to cut education funding by about 30%, just deep, deep cuts. And at the same time, he's been advocating bankruptcy as a solution, right? So the state does not currently authorize cities to file bankruptcy. He's trying to change that law to allow that to happen. And so you really have this case where it's kind of similar to Michigan, where the state cut funding to the city and then said, hey, you should file bankruptcy. Rauner's trying to do the same thing, slash funding to cities and then saying, well, you're in such dire financial straits, the only thing you can do is file bankruptcy, and then you can shed these, then you can shed your pension obligations.
The word bankruptcy can be a little confusing because in colloquial speech it means just you're broke. In legal speech it refers to a complicated procedure for getting out of debt. What are we talking about with Chicago? As you said earlier, it's legally not able to file for bankruptcy. So why are people throwing around this word?
Yeah, I mean, so you're exactly right. So, I mean, basically, to file bankruptcy, the way the cities file bankruptcy is through Chapter 9 of the Bankruptcy Code. And under Chapter 9, you can only file bankruptcy if the state authorizes you to do so. 26 states, including Illinois, do not. But the reason why we keep seeing everyone sort of, you know, as you mentioned earlier, that why everyone sort of talking about which city will be the next Detroit and basically naming just about every big city that exists is that the threat of bankruptcy can be really strong in sort of raising public support or at least public acceptance of things that are otherwise not palatable. So, for instance, in Chicago, you know, you have a mayor who was extremely unpopular who was reelected because he did sort of try to invoke, he did invoke the threat of bankruptcy, saying, well, if you don't elect me, you'll go into bankruptcy, the city will go into bankruptcy, and we'll all have, you know, we'll all be miserable. And the thing is that it's sort of great scaremongering because it can then, you can sort of say, well, we have no choice, you know, this isn't great, but we got to do this, otherwise we'll go bankrupt. And who knows what will happen in bankruptcy. We don't want to be Detroit. So people don't necessarily understand what municipal bankruptcy actually is, but they know that it's bad. And they know that they don't want to be that. I mean, the thing that is really important to understand about bankruptcy is that in the context of bankruptcy, creditors' interests come first, right? So taxpayers' interests take a back seat. In the context of the bankruptcy process, the judge's job is not to ensure that there's, you know, adequately funded services or that schools stay open or that communities have what they need to survive. His job is to make sure that creditors are able to get what they're owed. And yes, there is sort of this, you know, a broader public policy thing that you do want to make sure the city is actually able to eventually get back on its feet, but that's not the primary goal. And so what bankruptcy actually does is it actually allows, it basically is a way to take control of public decision-making, public policy out of the hands of elected officials and instead puts it in the hands of the creditors, which is really problematic.
I'm speaking with Saki Bhatti, who is the director of the Refund America Project and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He's based in Chicago. You said earlier that Rauner sees bankruptcy as a solution. What is the problem it is a solution to?
I mean, I think in his mind, the problem, well, actually, I won't venture to say what's going on in his mind. It certainly appears from what he's saying that the problem he sees is pensions and unions, right? He sort of said that he wants to destroy unions in Illinois in the next 4 years, and he's trying to make it so that cities and the state can get out of their pension obligations. And so one of the key things that we have in Illinois is there was actually an income tax, a temporary income tax hike that went into effect a couple of years ago that sunsetted at the end of last year. And he's refused to extend that. And so it sort of created this real hole on top of the budget pressure that already existed. It's created an additional $6 billion hole. There is a real revenue crisis in Illinois. The fact is that the state of Illinois, the government is broke. The city of Chicago is broke, but they're broke on purpose because they're broke because they refuse to actually have a progressive taxation system. Illinois has the fifth most regressive tax system of any state in the country. Two-thirds of corporations don't pay any taxes, any income taxes. And instead of sort of talking about how we can fix that, instead of trying to raise corporate taxes or at the very least restore the corporate taxes that just declined, or working towards a millionaire's tax or taxing the financial exchanges that we have in Chicago. Instead, the talk is all about we need to cut X, Y, and Z. We need to cut education, cut state aid to cities. We need to cut pensions. And it's all sort of part of this broader agenda to really push austerity and have an even lower tax climate, basically to have a system in which poor people and working class communities are forced to bear the brunt of the budget crisis, and the banks, corporations, the 1% get off the hook.
Yeah, I was thinking when you mentioned austerity, it's not for Rauner's private equity friends or the futures traders on LaSalle Street, right?
No, absolutely not. When they talk about shared sacrifice, they mean poor people sharing in all the sacrifice.
And now Moody's, the bond rating firm, just lowered Chicago's rating to near junk levels. If they take it down another notch or two, then it triggers default clauses, which are going to cost the city tons of money, right? So what's going on with Moody's?
Yeah, so that's actually already happened. So this happened about maybe a month ago, or maybe 2 months ago, that the city, Moody's did further downgrade both the city and the school district. And so now both of their credit ratings are at junk level. And that has triggered termination clauses on a series of deals. I mean, for the city now owes about between penalties on their swap deals and accelerated repayment clauses, the city now owes about $2.2 billion in payments. The school district, CPS, Chicago Public Schools, also owes about $260 million in termination clauses on their swap deals. This downgrade by Moody's has sort of set into motion a series of events that are going to prove very, very costly for both the city and the school district. I mean, it is a real concern. It's one of those things where it creates a spiral because you get a rating downgrade and suddenly and now you have to refinance all this debt. And because you got a rating downgrade, now the debt is more expensive. Because a rating downgrade is like getting a lower, getting your credit score dinged. And so it means that at precisely the moment that you need to refinance, the cost of borrowing is higher than ever has been. It's not a good scene.
Now, you mentioned the swap deals and other things. Chicago, like many municipalities around the country, have entered into these preposterously complex transactions to borrow money. Instead of just floating old-fashioned municipal bonds with a fixed coupon, they have done all these floating rate things with swaps and caps and all kinds of other fancy bells and whistles. I always wonder about the subsequent employment history of the municipal officials that enter into these deals, because they make no sense other than wanting to go work for an investment bank someday. But talk some about the kinds of arrangements that Chicago and other cities have entered into that make this borrowing business much riskier and much more expensive.
Sure. I mean, really, and to sort of talk about that, we have to understand sort of the background with this, right, which is that if we look at what's happened over the course of the last 35 years in this country, there really has been a 35-year plan since the start of the Reagan Revolution to defund a delegitimized government and really push down taxes. And so, tax rates have very much plummeted over the course, not just in Chicago, but really across the country, on top income earners and corporations over the last 35 years or so. And it's happened at the same time that we've seen the greatest sort of amount of population growth in our country. And so what you've had is basically revenues going down at the same time the expenses are going up. Well, the only way that you can deal with that is by taking out more debt. And as cities have taken out more and more debt to start making just to make ends meet, banks have sort of shifted their business model to start targeting them for predatory deals, right? In much the same way that they sold predatory mortgages to homeowners who were cash strapped. Deals that had hidden costs, hidden risks, were overly complex, often designed to fail. They've done very much the same thing with cities and states. They sort of basically saw cities that were in dire straits that needed to figure out a way to make ends meet because their tax revenues weren't keeping up with their expenses. And they said, well, here's something we can do. We have this deal that'll save you some money. And if you do this, you'll be sort of good for the next so many years. And the thing is that, well, as a city official, if you're sort of looking at having to make drastic cuts, or this guy telling you that, and it usually is a guy, telling you that here's a way that you can save some money and come off better in the long run, it seems quite appealing. But the thing is that this is sort of the basic thing that finance officials often forget, is that the banker that you're dealing with is not actually trying to save you money. They're trying to make themselves money. Their job isn't to give you the best deal. Their job is to make the most profit. And so very often deals like interest rate swaps, when they were pitched, the bankers would downplay the risks. They would highlight the potential savings. And in many cases, when they did this, it was actually in violation of federal regulations that required them to make sure to actually explain deals and all the risks and benefits fully, and in a way as if they actually want you to understand what they're saying. And so under the federal regulations, you can't just talk about the upside without talking about the downside. It's not good enough to sort of say, well, yes, there are these risks, but they probably won't materialize, so don't worry about them. And very often that was sort of the tack that bankers took when pitching these types of deals to the officials. And so they sort of said, look, do this, you'll save tons of money. But what they sort of left out was, well, here's what the risk would be if these deals backfire, and here's how likely these deals actually are to backfire. And what we're seeing in Chicago, these termination fees on interest rate swaps, they're huge. The city and the school district thus far have already made about $800 million in payments on these deals. They had already made about $800 million in payments on these swap deals thus far before these downgrades. These downgrades together have triggered, between the city and the state and the school district, about $450 million more in payments. And so together, that's about over $1.2 billion. And there is, there's a strong legal case to actually that if the city and the school district were to sort of file legal challenges to these deals, they could get their money back. But the mayor has refused to pursue those legal angles, instead sort of opting to see a contract as a contract and we can't get out of these deals. You talk to any union person who he's dealt with over the last 5 years or the last 4 years, and ask them what Mayor Emanuel thinks about the sanctity of a contract, and you'll get a different story. But the reality, of course, is that what we're saying is that if the banks broke the law in how they sold these deals, then they actually violated the contract, and so you have a strong means to get out of them. The state of Illinois actually also has similar deals, interest rate swap deals, where the payments have also been massive, and Governor Rauner also refuses to take legal action to get out of the deals and to try to get the money back.
You would think that they would want to get this. We're not talking trivial sums. You would think they'd want to explore every avenue to invalidate these deals, which are going to cost them hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. They certainly don't feel any shyness about trying to get out of pension promises. So, what do you think is motivating them?
Well, I think that's exactly it. But this, at the end of the day, comes down to an ideological decision. We saw the same thing in Detroit, where basically in Detroit, Detroit also had these deals, and they had paid hundreds of millions in payments on them. And during the crunch of the bankruptcy, they're on the hook for another $350 million in penalties. And the judge was sort of insisting, saying, you can't pay out this amount. You need to file a lawsuit to get this money back or negotiate a lower deal. And the judge had to basically reject the city's payout to the banks twice and finally get the number lower to $85 million. So basically the number came at $265 million, and that's money that the city was just going to give away. And really what it gets to is this broader agenda, right? The reason why we're talking about bankruptcy in these cities isn't really because there's no money. We're talking about bankruptcy because they're trying to use bankruptcy as a way to get slash pensions. And so in Detroit, the reason why the city was not trying to slash the swaps or force the banks to take a haircut was because their preferred answer was to force pensioners to bear the full cost. Similarly, in Chicago, Rahm Emanuel would much rather try to slash pensions than force his friends on Wall Street to take a haircut. And the other thing that is sort of worth mentioning, right, in Chicago Public Schools, David Vitale, who's the president of the school board, he was a person who actually, he was, at the time that the CPS entered into their swap deals, he actually was the chief administrative officer for CPS. He was a person who engineered these deals. And his background is in finance, right? He used to be a board member at the predecessor bank, JP Morgan Chase. He most recently was at the Chicago Board of Ed, Chicago Board of Trade. And he's a person who actually did these deals, and now, he sort of stands by them. If it was simply a matter of trying to get back all the money they possibly can, they would absolutely be trying to recover these losses. But really, the issue is that they're broke on purpose. They're choosing to be broke so that they can push a broader political agenda that slashes pensions and lets banks and corporations off the hook.
Saki Bhatia of the Roosevelt Institute. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, new from Peaches. Till next week, bye.